It's hard to hear the word no when your dreams seem to be hanging by a thread. But man's rejection is God's protection, so when someone tells you no, it may be the start of something that will change the world.
Newly restored to glorious 4K, the 1968 documentary, The Queen, depicts the scandalous crowning of a drag queen pageant winner, much to the dismay of fellow contestant Crystal LaBeija, who went on to create the ballroom culture we've come to know through the film Paris is Burning and the TV show Pose.
Today, comedian Matt Brown joins us to take a look at the pre-Stonewall documentary film The Queen, and how sometimes the worst decisions can spark a revolution.
Plus, Kevin Hart gets blasted for pretending not to understand homophobia after Lil Nas X talks about why it was so important for him to come out at the height of his career.
Azalea Banks reads Lizzo to filth.
And rainbow flags are flown in Europe to protest the visit of Vice President Mike Pence.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Look at her! Her makeup is terrible! But I love you anyway!
Feast of Fun is made possible because of the support of fierce, fabulous people like you. Become a member and listen to 14 years of amazing podcasts at feastoffun.com/plus. Or put a tip in our tip jar and make a one-time donation at feastoffun.com/donate. Thank you for your support.
No is very important, like in a career, in a life. Like, no is a complete sentence. No is necessary. I love turning shit down. No's great. No's great.
Americans are mostly afraid of no in terms of negotiation, in terms of hearing the response to a desire.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was really profoundly transformational in my life when I became friends with the word no and became to embrace it.
You have to be supremely confident to actually do that, though, because you either have to have the confidence in your talent, the confidence in your bank, the confidence in what you do to say that if you do say, no, this won't work for me under these terms, if I'm going to be part of this, I need this. Like what you just offered is unacceptable. You actually have to be prepared to walk. And most people are not actually prepared to leave a shitty situation.
Yeah. Mm. The landmark documentary film from 1967, The Queen, is out in theaters that chronicles the behind-the-scenes look at a pageant in New York City that sparked an outrage because this ingenue won the pageant. Mm-hmm. And Crystal LaBeija met Pepper LaBeija at that pageant and started the whole house and voguing scene in New York City because of it.
Shortly afterwards.
Ultimately leading to Paris is Burning, leading to our favorite TV show Pose on FX. Even RuPaul's Drag Race wouldn't be what it is today if it wasn't for that pageant's outcome where Crystal did not win and she heard the word no because there was injustice and racism and it stung and she did something about it and transformed the world.
Oh, yeah. No, every fit she's ever thrown completely inspires. Like when I read my emails and I get rejected from shit or like when I get an audition and then the audition's taken away or moved around or something, I'm just like, are they serious? Do they know who I am? I've been an artist since I was 11 years old. I've won singing competitions. I've paid all my own bills. Fuck these motherfuckers. Like, I completely lose my mind like she does, but in the privacy of my own home. There's
just
no camera.
Darling.
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 Oh, and one of my favorite quotes in life from this fucking film is that when Crystal is losing her mind, when she is losing her mind at the end, one of the judges is like, you're showing your color. And she's like, I have every right to show my color. Yes.
Talking to us is comedian Matt Brown, who understands full well the phrase, man's rejection is God's protection.
Oh, yes.
That means when somebody says no to you, they're opening up a door. They're opening up opportunities for other people to embrace and say yes to you.
Or even maybe is good enough sometimes.
Yeah, because then you can get in on charm and everyone likes to, somebody knows how to suck dick. Yeah, no. And the other super important thing about no that people forget is that it is important to have long term like goals. You need to constantly be reaching for something. Because if you get everything you want after 2 years, well, sit on your ass.
As Seven of Nine said on Star Trek Voyager, may all your dreams come true except one. So you're always sweating and struggling to get that dream come true.
Well, I'm always going to want to be Diana Ross, so I'm always have some work in front of me.
Matt, you saw The Queen when you were a wee little gay on YouTube.
Yeah, I was on YouTube. Or... Mm-hmm. That's where I got most of my gay education from, like, documentaries like The Queen and, like, Varla Jean Merman's YouTube channel and shit. That's where, like, I got my, like, faggotry essentials, so to speak. And I fucking loved watching it because in this film it was such like a classic documentary that was talking about like this Warhol culture in a very non-Warhol mm-hmm. way, which I really liked. Like the subjects actually moved. It wasn't just the Empire State Building for 9 hours. And so the other thing that's really interesting about a lot of gay film, even up to this point, is that it's a commentary through silence about racial situations, because no one ever really directly says anything about race till like the end, I would say, when Crystal kind of, you know, Hilo's this white girl and da 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 da. But you can tell in looks and you can tell in the way people will speak and you can tell in the way that people will interact that there's a constant specific dynamic that is taking place.
Well, especially because it's competition. So it's competition exactly. And there's race. So you're sizing up the competition and you have to figure in like the racial component of what that's going to mean in the end result.
Yeah, you have to really see your judges are.
Mm-hmm. But this is 1967. Mm-hmm. And if you think about like other pageants and other contests, they were all segregated.
Oh, big time.
So it's something to a testament of LGBTQ culture that we were working, we were fighting with each other. We were talking about these issues in 1967.
Totally.
2 years before Stonewall. The film, the pageant was captured in 1967. It was released in 1968. And, you know, since then, it's being discussed all over the world and it's influenced so many filmmakers. I would say, like, you know, and when you think about some of the greatest documentary films ever made, mm-hmm. we put on that list Pumping Iron, which chronicles Lou Ferrigno and Arnold Schwarzenegger's rivalry.
And what's his name just died?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And his best friend, Franco Colombo.
I liked Lou Ferrigno way more after he couldn't hear.
Well, I think that was in the film.
He always couldn't hear.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. The voice got way worse with age, and I was into it. It just made me laugh on The Celebrity Apprentice.
And that film has very much a queer aesthetic in the sense that these are men
flexing and showing their muscles to other men.
Developing their bodies for other men, and this sort of like insecurity, and Arnold Schwarzenegger just blossoms as this character, larger than life character that we grew to love. And you think about Paris is Burning, just the way it just beautifully captures New York's ball scene and voguing and these really complicated characters. When we think about, you know, The Queen, these documentaries describe the world, the human condition so well that it's hard to talk about documentaries without talking about the queer experience.
Absolutely, because it's always been about telling the story that hasn't been heard and hasn't been seen. And so we have always been sort of pushed to the outer realms of society. So that's the first place that an intelligent person would want to shine a light. Something also that I think is really super interesting about the whole documentary experience as it pertains to queer people is that it's sort of like our first, if you really think about, and this is a stretch, but you follow me, without like movies like The Queen and without like, you know, a lot of the stuff that Warhol did later with Hollywood Lawn and a lot of stuff, it wouldn't be possible necessary for like a show like How I Met Your Mother to exist with like what's his name, Neil Patrick Harris, with those kids that they bought from Russia or whatever. I don't know, those kids are probably Russian spies and they elected Donald Trump, I bet. But what I'm saying is the reason it makes that all possible is because instead of there being an ensemble cast of straight people, it put gay people in the straight world. Like they were in a drag show, but they were at Town Hall, which is like a very historic performance venue. They were in the New York City interacting with police officers, interacting with outside forces, like
They were in a hotel that they had to make sure a hotel that would even accept them.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, like, instead of there being an ensemble cast, the whole, like, mise-en-scene, mm-hmm. the whole, like, sort of set of New York City and the actual world inhabited, mm-hmm. instead of us being, like, case subjects or, like, weirdos or freaks that existed in this own, like, you know, sort of multiple maniacs, John Waters, mm-hmm. sort of, like, enclave of weirdness, we were in the real world with everybody else and heroes. We stood out. Mm-hmm. We stood out, but we were there and we were fine.
I remember when we interviewed Patrick Bristow, who was, you know, the choreography in the movie Showgirls, and he's was the best friend to Ellen.
Oh, that work of
Ellen's
art.
TV show. And he said that when he took a role, he's like, he didn't care if some of the characters didn't like him, but the main characters had to have a good relationship with them. He had to be seen as a person. Like, the other person might be able to make fun of him for being a faggot, mm-hmm. But, like, not them.
And it wasn't that awareness really wasn't cemented until Vito Russo's The Celluloid Closet, mm-hmm. Which first came out as a book and then later as a film. And, you know, and certainly like the work of Marlon Briggs and Tongues Untied.
I thought you were going to say Marlon Brando, and I'm like, yeah, his work of sucking Richard Pryor's dick really moved the whole movement.
Oh, we have to talk about that later. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
We must.
And to me, it's like, you know, like The Queen is considered one of the most interesting documentaries, one of the most important documentaries mm-hmm. of all time. And it's great that now it's in 4K. It's touring theaters. It's probably going to go on your streaming services eventually. But if you get a chance to see it, it really, mostly gay
audience. Because it's 4K, right?
It's 4K.
Doesn't mean it costs $4,000 for our, like, no. viewers in India and shit. It's people do not know.
You see all their horrible makeup.
Yes. But Crystal LaBeija never had a pore.
Still doesn't. Yeah.
While we're on the topic of The Queen, before we close out on it, something I just want to sort of let our viewers think about here for a second. With The Queen, what's super important about the time period with, like, the whole, like, how it's mid-60s, it's still very, like, with the civil rights era, something that you'll notice in art, in society, is when there's the biggest, like, structural resistance towards people, when there's the biggest governmental revolt, art accepts them with, like, big open arms. Like, if you really look back at it, there were never more black opera singers and black conductors and black ballet dancers than the 1960s and 1970s in this country. It's very interesting.
How does that happen? What's the mechanism?
And it's very interesting there because you'll have great singers, like, for example, this is like a literal example, like Leontine Price, who was literally one of the highest paid people in the field in the 1960s, who would go on tour, go sing this opera for 3 hours in Dallas, and then not be able to get a hotel afterwards because it's 1964. Mm-hmm. It's very weird, but it's a sort of, like, I think it was sort of pre-institutional affirmative action. It's like, we see what we're doing to this country. So it's like, when we see people who do seem that they could be special, we'll find a way to scholarship it out. We'll find a way mm-hmm. to nourish them. We'll find a way to nurture this talent. Because, like, when you think about it, there are a lot of actors, especially, like, stage actors, like Morgan Freeman, who came out in the 60s, like Sidney Poitier, stage stuff that was coming in the 50s and 60s. When there's the greatest structural resistance, every other community realizes, no, this is who needs the focus. Mm. This is who, like, where a lot of talent can be found. Because oppression breeds artistic expression, unfortunately.
Well, Francois Clemens, who was the first openly gay and first black recurring children's television show actor and character.
He wasn't mm-hmm. out during the TV show, though.
But he was.
That would have been Mario Cantone.
But no, he was, you know, in terms of, like, being a pioneer, he was one of the earliest ones to come out as gay.
Yeah.
And he said.
Did he come out in the 70s or the 80s?
What?
Did he come out in the 70s or the 80s?
I
or do you know?
Don't know that specific, but he certainly talked out extensively on our podcast about it. And he said that. And it really mirroring sort of Nichelle Nichols, why she got on Star Trek, was for a lot of African-Americans, it was a moral and it was their civic duty to get out there into difficult and uncomfortable places where they were not represented to be seen and heard.
Absolutely. I was actually.
And I don't think people feel that way today.
I don't necessarily want to say that that's all true. I think some of it's generational, but you're reminding me of a conversation I was having with another gay male comedian, really one of, like, he's not old, so I don't want to call him one of my forefathers, but genuine inspirations in what I do this. He was the first gay comedian I ever saw on TV. His name's Ty Rivera. His website is
America. We know Ty Rivera. Yeah, he was on the show.
On this podcast.
America'sFavoriteFag.com. That's the funniest website in the world. My God. That's hilarious. But he did a Facebook Live about it, and we were sort of talking about it, you know, in DMs and stuff, about how being a gay comedian, and specifically because our shared experiences being gay male comedians of color, he's Mexican, I'm biracial, black American, it's about, instead of that normal experience of comedy is about making your experiences relatable to people who are like you and sort of making it a bonding thing, we have to go to people who are not like us and talk about experiences that they have never had and make them still want to be our friend and understand. It's a completely different experience, but it harkens back to that 60 thing, that 1960s notion of like, listen, we just have to own that we're weird and then we'll get everyone with us.
Yeah. Do you feel, now we talked about this before we started taping,
mm-hmm.
unlike a lot of African Americans who are also queer,
yeah.
you feel your homosexuality first and your race second.
I feel like I am perceived by other I'm perceived by other people as okay. gay first before, because I'm,
which is different than most African Americans.
Yeah, because most black gay guys are definitely, and
black first and gay second.
And I like emotionally, like personally identify with that first. I think I lead my life as black and poor first.
And why are people ranking that? Is part of it is just to understand how deeply something impacts you.
It is to the notion of how deeply something impacts you. And then it's also to say where you understand your true comfort and your true allegiance to be. I feel much more comfortable at Francis's on 75th Street.
What's that?
Or it's just like a bar on the south side. Okay. I feel much more confident there or at a dive bar on the northwest side than I do at a gay bar in Boys Town. That's me. That's how I feel. That's who I am.
So Kevin Hart, who lost his Oscars gig, the comedian,
yes.
Over a stand-up routine about not wanting a gay son.
He gave up the Oscar gig.
He gave it up, but I guess then Ellen said, I forgive you. And people are like, Ellen, you don't speak for all LGBT people.
Ellen doesn't even speak for Porsche's horses.
He pretended not to understand the homophobia in the black community when a musician, Lil Nas.
Mm-hmm, Lil Nas X.
Lil Nas X.
Because Nas was like rapper 15 years ago.
And Lil Nas X's song is historically the most popular mm-hmm. song.
It's the longest number one song to like maintain
in history.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because of the remixes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, because before, well, because you know what's really funny? You can't really chart stuff the same way anymore, because like it used to be One Sweet Day with Mariah Carey and Boyz II Men and stuff, mm-hmm. but then J-Lo got the remixes in, so that's how Lil Nas is in.
So mm-hmm. Lil Nas is having a conversation with Kevin Hart on a new television program, HBO's The Shop Uninterrupted.
It takes place in a barber shop.
In a barber shop.
That's the only time where black men get together and talk, right?
Yeah, no, otherwise we're too busy grunting and searching for white women to rape.
And so Lil Nas was asked why he felt it was important to make an announcement that he was gay after such early success.
Yeah.
And he just said, you know, it's like I'm at the top of my game. I'm at the height of my career and I want to make a statement and I'm going to be coming out as gay. Basically, you know, making people like Ricky Martin, who came out long after his career was over, with a very lucrative book deal, shaking in his
and don't you love how boots. Ricky Martin forced his kids to grow their hair out and be trans? Like, I'm still trying to figure that one out.
Matteo and Valentino, he has a third child now.
Oh, he does?
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't know the name of the third child.
Did he get it from Malawi or is it another sperm donor?
I don't know.
He actually took one of Madonna's extras. She keeps them in a closet. But
it might be her egg. She might have frozen some eggs somewhere. Who knows?
Yeah, 1981 in her fucking studio apartment in Bayside.
So you saw Kevin Hart reacting to that conversation, and he's like, why do you have to hate homosexuality? And Lil Nas is like, come on now.
Someone needs to ask Kevin Hart why he's on the DL, because then that man is 5'4". You know, he grabs his feet like a baby when he's getting his ass ate. Like,
is he that short?
Yeah, he's like, he's not like Little People, Big World, but like he's got a big heart.
What do you make of that? What do you make of that conversation that you guys saw?
Well, what I can't seem to understand of it is how any adult who's grown up in America and is like Kevin Hart's age, because he's like 40, like he's a grown-ass adult man. Mm-hmm. It's not like he's like 22 and like my age and like, the world's a great place that you can get married. Like, he's seen the way shit is. How are you going to realistically be surprised when someone says, yeah, growing up, I was kind of, I thought that being gay meant life was going to be harder for me. Mm-hmm. Why is that surprising?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think he's kind of playing dumb with the whole kind of thing. But also too, I kind of feel like even today you have a conversation with some people about what it is to be gay or queer, and they're acting like, you know, it's no problem. Nobody has any problem with it anymore. That, you know, it's like, why are you worried about it? It's just like, well, for most of my life, a lot of people have had a lot of problems mm-hmm. with it. And even today, still people have a lot of problems.
But I always think it's so funny.
You can't just wash all that stuff away.
No, and people think it stops when you leave school. Mm-hmm. People think that once you graduate high school or something, that like it all goes away. Mm-hmm. Like employment discrimination isn't a thing. like you can just magically even change like your voice and your body work language.
Environment, you know, somebody like, you know, feminizing your name and you may be gender non-binary, mm-hmm. but they're almost outing you or they're forcing you into a feminine space that you're not controlling is a form of harassment, you know, and some people Absolutely. Just don't even know how to, and they're trying to be playful or something. And it's mm-hmm. like, you know, it's about like creating spaces where people are allowed to be authentic selves and not feel like they're on the defensive in any regard.
Yeah. Cause you gotta be able to be yourself.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I think everyone like every like I feel like my fucking grandma. This just sounds so Midwestern, but I just feel like every young person just deserves the right to be who they are. Like, I just feel like you go around this earth fucking one time. You should just get to do what makes you you.
Now, do you feel like people have a harder time accepting no today than they did in the past?
I think that people have it's bipolar. There are two sides to it.
There's this idea that like our, you know, regardless of the age, that Americans are more entitled and more easily angered when they're not getting what they want. And so this is kind of stemming from you know, the access of social media. And when somebody reveals a plot spoiler to a television show or a movie, they're just like, how dare you pop my bubble and mm-hmm. interrupt my life with
but
information.
But how different is that from the Trump shit of like, I want to be entitled to my ignorance. Why are you giving me information? Stop
it. It's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. You're not going to be in control of what other people say and do necessarily.
No,
but you can certainly be in control of how you react to it.
Absolutely. But people want to blame a little too much on the cell phone, a little bit too much on the computer, because the progression of technology, the Industrial Revolution in and of itself is enough to make you fucking spoiled. Because there used to be a point in time where if you didn't like the meat that you got at your neighborhood grocery store, you're a vegetarian now. There weren't options. Like, there was no Amazon delivery. There was no other place. You couldn't go somewhere 30 miles away because
that was a plot
really
of good times.
Good times, anytime. No.
Remember that there was a plot of the good times that the neighborhood meat market was selling spoiled meat. And so I don't understand how they convinced.
Good Times was talking about food deserts before Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
Can we just.
And so
Esther Roll is a revolutionary.
Florida took the steak and forced it to feed it on the superintendent of the supermarket. Mm-hmm. And he was like, oh, I can't eat that steak. It's rotten. So they basically stopped selling rotten meat. So, which was a really bogus plot.
Because it's like, if you give white people a taste of their own medicine, they finna change. No. No. Wrong. Well,
it was a black-owned business, too.
Oh, really?
That was poisoning the community.
Oh, so that's like sort of like Valerie Jarrett, how she owned all those slum homes like all around here and then didn't maintain them. And she's like, I'm here for black people. Bitch, you look white. Roseanne might have been right. Anyway. So we just like to throw him a sideways one that I might not mean.
That's what I really enjoyed about the Queen documentary is this. It was just seeing.
We're still on the Queen. We're like 45 minutes in. We're still talking about topic
number
one.
Well, part of me is like, I want to travel back in time and, you know, imagine like what it would be like to be thrust into that situation, mm-hmm. you know? And I just thought about like how different queer people's bodies were.
Yes.
Like,
and how they talked about it. Like, one of my other favorite phrases in it was when they're all in the hotel rooms and they're all just sitting in the beds, like talking together, like
and they're
boys.
Naked.
Yeah, it's like the behind the scenes things with RuPaul Drag Race. Mm-hmm. They're just sitting on the bed. One of them says, so are you feminine in bed? That's such a funny question to me. Are you feminine in bed?
But part of it is like, you know, like in Americans, we're just thicker. We all that high fructose corn syrup, but we exercise differently.
Yeah.
We think about our bodies differently. And the idea of an athletic body on a woman or a man was something that was very foreign to people.
Yeah.
And so we're, you know, ironically, I don't know if we're healthier or not, but we're certainly exercising a lot more and we're consuming a lot more calories than that generation did.
Big time.
And, it, you know, this is way before the AIDS crisis. And they didn't strike me as any more sexually active than we are today or less than at any point in time. They just seemed like they were enjoying each other's company and they were really like happy to be together. And there was a lot of like community spirit that you just don't see anywhere.
It's a weird thing because I feel like that was a part of that lack of sort of notice on the sexual quantity or quality is sort of the same way of demonstrating like the whole like acceptance and disgustance at the same like time. Because like, sure, the police would protect them and sure, there's all this stuff because you're being paid off. But at the same time, the fact that we don't really know anything about their sex lives and the fact that no one really was asking any questions about our sex lives until the AIDS crisis, when everyone suddenly needed to know numbers and tally marks, need to know everything you'd ever done the past fucking 5 years.
But if you look like at RuPaul's Drag Race, all the drag queens are like chummy with each other. They're snuggling. They're kissing each other. You know, last season there was a sexual relationship between two of the contestants.
That's disgusting.
It was a total sham. But still.
But also to the yell
I'll pretend
at each
to
other.
Fuck anybody on the Real World, though. Me just too? Put me on VH1.
I would take all my clothes and say, who wants the piece of me?
I would like wear a burqa and then just like make them work for it. That would like just like Salome with the 77 veils.
Do you have a hard time, Mark, Matt, hearing the word no when it comes to your desires, sexual, career, emotional, artistic?
What do you do when a guy tells you you have to use a condom, Mark? You can tell me. It's okay. Just let me know all the emotions that go through your mind and we can just go through this together as sisters.
I'm okay with it. It's fine. You know?
Sorry, that's a black nationalist.
You're like, I am on PrEP. What the fuck am I taking these pills for?
Well, I'm sexually Muslim, so we don't use condoms. Anyway.
Well, I figure if they want to use it, they're probably doing it for a reason. Like they might think that I'm a dirty hoe.
Or maybe their asshole's itchy.
Or maybe they've got something.
Yeah, but they're still trying to rent it out like a storage unit.
You know?
Yeah.
So they want a little bit of that protection. Who knows?
Slightly. You know? Do you have a favorite brand of condom or like style or something?
Magnum.
Okay. So you're packing heat yourself.
Or 7 Plus.
I'm not familiar with 7 Plus. Are those like the Chinese ones? Or are those like the Asian ones?
I don't know. I don't even know.
I like the big condoms just because they're not as tight on my dick.
But I don't want them to be like too roomy. I can wear a Magnum, but I do not require one. So
because you try to ejaculate into a tight condom and it's like sneezing with your nostrils.
I feel
plugged
like it's
up.
Choking you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's why I don't wear Durex. Those are like the free shit they give you out of the clinic. And it's like my dick feels like it's in a boxing glove. Mm-hmm. Like it's going to sting like a bee, but it will not fly like a feather.
If you're going to get some at the free clinic, get the ones that are like gold. I think they're kings.
It's gold. It's gold. It's gold. It's gold. It's solid gold, baby. It's Beyonce's birthday, motherfucker. Show some respect.
Happy birthday.
Queen Bey.
Yes.
A moment of silence. Moment's over.
Okay, yeah, my friend fucking Malik put this Instagram post on, it's Beyonce's 38th birthday. I'm like, why are you saying her age all out loud like that? Like, she's like Mariah Carey. She's permanently 12. We don't ask questions.
Beyonce's, how old is she really?
38.
Okay.
Yeah, damn. She's born in 81. Older.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mark, you have a shortcut when people give you trouble on dating apps or sexual apps.
What kind of trouble would you even get?
Yeah, you say, you got this one from me.
Which one's that?
You ask for so much and offer so little.
I don't really use that one so much anymore.
What kind of like issues do you run into on apps? Because like I'm barely on them anymore.
People asking for a bunch of photos and they don't want to send you any photos. And it's just like, well, listen, it's like these are the ones you're getting. It's like, no, you're not getting 20 photos. You have 5.
Well, also, how hard is it to just go on page 9 of Google and steal some shit?
You know?
Like, if you're gonna, like, just be a scammer, be a scammer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, try.
Yeah.
Like, be a good mafioso.
I have a pretty good intuition as to when people are catfishing.
I like catfishing. I want to believe the fantasy.
Oh, you like being lied to? You're like one of those mafia wives who just wants them to come home and tuck you in bed at night?
I'm like, you know what? Maybe this time will be... You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, I like a little bit of fantasy.
Okay.
Fantasy, cha-cha bitch.
It feels so sweet.
Cha-cha bitch.
Oh, yeah.
But see, the thing is, like, with a no, it's like, you know, if a no is just often sometimes just the start of a negotiation.
Sometimes.
So I might tell you no at first, but in the end, it might be a yes.
That's also from Brock Turner's diary.
Actually, it's from a hostage negotiator book I read.
Okay, so Patty Hearst. Okay. Just change around to a different blonde person.
Well, see, there's going to be three old people who get that Patty Hearst.
This is a good idea. When you allow somebody to tell you no, it puts them in control. So I'm not trying to like trick you or anything like that. It's like you are in control. I respect the no, you know, but you know, depending on how you phrase that question is what you're going to get. So, 'cause like you wouldn't, Matt, like if we don't have sex, do you want to go home horny? Is that what you're looking to do?
So
in, no, I don't.
I just want to understand here.
See, okay. see how it works.
Like, like that. Okay.
But listen to the technique that Mark's offering so to you, because it could change your life forever. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So let's say you're trying to get a gig or something like that, and the guy's telling you no. He's just like, well, you don't want to leave your audience disappointed.
Mm-hmm. Do you?
Do you? And you'd be like, no, I don't want to leave them disappointed. Well, maybe they'd like my type of humor then.
You're right.
You know?
See how that works?
Something to offer.
Because
let me break out my knee pads.
Listen to this idea. It's more powerful to allow someone to come up to the conclusion that you want them to come up to than to try to persuade them to agree with you. Mm-hmm.
That is why I do my stand-up the way I do my stand-up. I don't tell straight people how to think. I show them who I am, and I let them like me.
Mm. Or hate you.
Well,
You went to... And fill us in on this. You went to Indiana.
Yes.
Because last time you were on the show...
Let me finish.
Last time.
Can I finish just one sentence here?
Yeah.
You went to Indiana to trash talk Pete Buttigieg and his husband Chase.
The last time you were on the show, we talked about whether you should go to South Bend, Indiana.
Because I was already going to go, but we didn't know if I needed to talk about Pete or not.
Yes.
We couldn't figure it out.
You had a whole bunch of like Chasen being a melting ice cream cone joke and that kind of stuff. And
okay. Yeah. So actually, because I was listening back to the recordings this week, because I wanted to talk about it like appropriately the way I actually covered it on stage, because when I went to South Bend, Indiana, and I was featuring at the Drop Comedy Club, which is a really fun spot in South Bend, there were three different shows I did on a Friday and a Saturday night, and the way I opened it was just really simple, because I like to ask, you know, because I have a bit about our mayor, so I like to talk about ourselves first. I make fun of Lori Lightfoot for looking like a James Brown impersonator. I talk about how, like, in the middle of her speeches, if you listen closely, she always whispers, "Get on up!" Like, it's always...
I hope she hears you do that.
If you pay close attention, like, because I don't even think anybody voted for her. Lori just vowed that she was going to grout every home and business in the city of Chicago, and we're like, I'm with her. Like, it was
lowest for her to turn out ever.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We did not give a fuck that year. We're just like, listen, she has 10 fingers. She's better than Rahm. I trust her. Mm. But I talk about, that's for, again, three people who read the Tribune
just
and get my jokes.
Just to clarify this, Rahm Emanuel is missing a digit.
He's missing a finger. Yeah. He cut it off, like, with a chainsaw, and then he went swimming afterwards, and it just sealed up.
Arby's or something. Wasn't it? Did he slice it off at an Arby's?
I like to pretend he worked behind the deli counter at a grocery store like Mickey Rourke and the Wrestler. But anyway.
That's kind of how Rahm Emanuel deals with everything in life.
He's just like, move on.
I know this is important. I know this is essential. My life will be significantly impacted for the worse. But fuck it, I don't care.
Listen, I know those kids should learn how to read, but I'm tired. That's very much his pursuit.
You know, I'm selling out Chicago's future just for a quick buck, but who cares?
There you go. So I talk a little bit shit about when I go in, I talk a little bit of shit about our mayor, and then I talk about why I think only gay people should be mayors, because we get kicked out of our houses so young we can fix homelessness for a city in a night. Like, again, it makes complete logistical sense. So I kind of go into shit that's talking about my community and my city, and then I ask them how they feel about Mayor Pete, and I, you know, you can tell by the applause if they want to go into it or not. And then the way I would...
So what did the applause sound like?
So, like, I would notice, because, like, the racial dynamics of the group was actually different for each three different shows. One was mostly white, one was white with like three black people, and then one was like half white, and then there were like a decent amount of black people and a couple Latino people, like four Mexican cops. Like, it was wild. So like, we got different things every different night. So like, racial dynamics are very important to voting. Like, anybody who just, again, went to school knows that. And so that really sort of shaped how people responded. But I would always ask, and that was sort of let me know who was in, who was down, who was whatever. And then I would just say, listen, I'm saying this humility, I'm saying this respect, I'm saying this with much like respect and fear and reverence of Indiana. Chasen Buttigieg is the ugliest person I've ever seen in my entire life. And they fucking laughed. They fucking laughed. I will more than happily edit the recordings of one of my sets to send it to you guys to like put on the fucking blog post for this video.
Okay.
Because like, I just say that and they just die. They just die. Because I just feel like if you're going to be the husband of the most powerful gay man in the United States of America, the least you could do is be attractive. The least you could do.
Hire a personal trainer.
Or just get a chin. A chin.
Go get a, you know, go get a good haircut.
Get a fucking facial wipe from TJ Maxx. Anything. Oh my God. Just some effort.
So they laughed at you making fun of him for being.
They were really in on
traditionally
it.
Traditionally unattractive.
Yeah, but they would even, South Bend, Indiana, they were ready to laugh at themselves. They even laughed about the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. They laughed when I did it. They didn't laugh when some other people talked about it.
Oh, really?
But, like, my shit was funny because I always like to make myself the joke. So, like, I would ask them, like, what they knew about it and what was going on. And this one woman, who's a nurse, was talking about how she saw a lot of ODs. And I just talked about how in my hometown, how I think we have an opioid crisis going on because everyone I went to high school with is selling everything in their house on Facebook Marketplace at 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. That's crackhead behavior. That is crackhead behavior.
Have you ever done OxyContin? Or had it done prescribed to you? Is it good?
Yes.
Is it better than Vicodin?
Vicodin plus coffee equals invincibility.
Yeah.
Oh, that's my favorite combo.
So OxyContin is better than Vicodin or about the same experience?
Because
I didn't like Vicodin.
Oh, I love Vicodin and a pot of coffee.
It's good if you're in pain from like a tooth extraction.
I don't know if I've ever had a Vicodin. Maybe once.
You've had Vicodin. Mm-hmm. I know you're my husband.
No, because like they started doing all the pain pill restrictions when I was in high school, and I got my wisdom teeth out really early, so I got a bunch of the good shit. And
so you actually got OxyContin.
Oh, yes, sir. Oh, yes, sir. Oh. And I didn't need it because getting my wisdom teeth didn't hurt. When I fractured my knee the next year and they didn't give me shit, that's when I got into pills. That was a fun summer. I should have made money off of them, but I just kind of hallucinated and enjoyed myself. And it was fine. It was fine.
Doesn't it get you constipated, though?
I already have that issue. So, like, it's no one's getting in my ass because they don't want to and they shouldn't. So,
I've done all kinds of drugs, but OxyContin is one that just hasn't managed to come on down my pipe.
I will say, though, if I had it all to do over again, I wouldn't have done it. I would have snorted like two lines of actual heroin and then just moved the fuck on with my life.
Mm. But we get something that's really good from the, that we've had because we've had people from the UK offer it to us. It's called, mm-hmm. It's caffeine and morphine together.
No, it's not morphine.
Solpadeine?
Solpadeine Plus.
Mm-hmm. And what's in it?
So it's an analgesic, a paracetamol or something like that, but then it also has a little bit of codeine in it, mm-hmm. and then some caffeine, and the caffeine kind of helps, you know, it's so a synergistic effect. So
codeine is not morphine.
Codeine is not morphine. It's in a they're related, but it's also, you know, not
that combo will also make you act a little cokey.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That explains a lot.
It will make you act a little cokey, and it will also, like, I would black out on it every now and again. Like, when I would mix, like, the caffeine with the, like, Vicodin and the pills and shit. Because, like, I didn't have an issue. I had a summer. It was different. I finished high school. I was free. When the first time I actually came up to Chicago, it was after I fractured my kneecap. I was up here with my high school boyfriend, and I was not, like, ready to really be, like, in a city where you had to walk, like, 7 miles in a day. And so I popped 4 of those Vicodin, drank a pot of coffee. I don't remember yelling at strangers in the street, but my boyfriend let me know about it when we got home the next day.
Holy shit, dude.
I was like screaming at him on the blue line, being like, you took this train the wrong backwards ass directions. I don't even have to look at Google Maps to know your stupid shit. Like, I was just backwards on everything. I was full crackhead, but I had a good time and my knee didn't hurt.
So South Bend liked you and they liked the Pete Buttigieg jokes. Did the other comedians do some Buttigieg jokes?
Who cares? Judge of America's Next Top Model. I don't care. Well, the other comedians didn't really do any Buttigieg jokes, but it was really funny because I hadn't been around people who like weren't in like a urban market, like in a big city market, mm-hmm. for a while. And so it was really funny to see just what like normal, like working everyday people, like one of my guest spot guys was just like, he was a fucking mail carrier. He was so funny. And he had some of the best jokes that I've heard anyone say about like our current immigration crisis and our current like detention center crisis, of anyone that I've seen in Chicago and of anyone that I've seen on the internet who's trying to talk about that shit. So it's just really cool to know that there's like really smart, layered people.
I wish I could hear that joke.
I don't want to say it because I'm not Latino and it's not my business to kind of go off on. He talks about it from the perspective of a Mexican American man, and it's I can't say it.
I do like Rachel Hall, your soul sister here in Chicago.
I love her comedy. She is great on all of her fucking social media platform. She's amazing.
So she was coming to tape a podcast with us, and she found like six avocados on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. And Mark said, be careful, that's a trap by ice.
Tienen aguacates para gratis? Oh, yeah.
And there's a little box with a stick trap and a string on, attached to it.
Lupe, correse! Like, it's very...
Now, you, well, a few shows back, you were we were talking about Azealia Banks.
She's still a soul sister.
Mm-hmm. Maybe not. She's going to force you to make a
What happened? Decision. What did she do that I don't know about?
Well, are you a fan of Lizzo?
I'm down with Lizzo.
Okay. She's not so down with Lizzo.
That's fine.
So this is what she said. Laughing my ass off the fact that the public and the media has been keep going with this fat girl joke going for so long is honestly peak boredom. This song is not good, nor is the dumpy fat girl spectacle live set she does. Saddest bit is that the girl is legit talented and is truly only being allowed to shine so long as she allows herself to be this millennial mammy of sorts. I honestly just hope this means she took the proverbial mammy L for cupcake. I don't know what that means. Who she originally stole the shtick from. I would love to see cupcake flourish without the simultaneous lust and disgust phenomenon Lizzo insults in the public. Queen Latifah was able to represent for larger women without being a disgusting or being a minstrel. So was Missy Elliott. Laughing my ass out. Lizzo is a really millennial mammy. I'm ready this joke be over. Because I'm sorry, why didn't we give Jasmine Sullivan all of this attention? She was a talented big girl because she wasn't making a fool of herself. Duh. Another parallel is Adele. Fat Adele gets to be fat, white, do a bootleg Mahalia Jackson impression.
Oh my god, call a doctor, I need a house call. Oh my god, Mahalia, she went back to the, oh my god, I need a doctor.
Well, finish it.
Take over, but Lizzo gotta jump around and act stupid to get half the attention while she has more talent than white Adele. Laugh my ass out, I can't stand Adele white ass. White people really reward her for being fat because I really don't think she can sing. Jessie J is eating Adele's foodendom anyway, any day, but Adele plays that fat white girl pity up so hard. After this, they better let Lizzo be a big star without having to do with all the extra shit, because the girl is legitimately talented, sans the Bruno Mars throwaway tracks.
Okay, so I'm going to get into this very delicately.
Okay.
I agree with every fucking word she said, and here's why. Okay. Wait, I'm down.
Hold on. Let me do this. Execs Black and White are complicit with the social program they've been tasked to do. I understand the body positivity thing, but if it were that, the most vulgar bits of it wouldn't be broadcast like that, laughing my ass off. Imagine what the rest of the world thinks when they see Lizzo jumping around in leotards with cellulite. No one said body positivity. She looks like she's making a fool of her black self or white American public. Nothing more, nothing less. All of this is happening purposely. It's not because any of these people are talented or deserving. It's just because execs know they are new faces and they won't get out of line, so to speak. And when they do, they'll say and do what the elite wants them to do.
I'm still down. Mm-hmm. I am still down. Like, down on me. Like, I am here for this. Okay. So, the reason why I give Lizzo a pass for the whole sort of very much appeasing a stereotype is because she can fucking sing. Like, she can, I'm going to say.
Are you talking about Azealia Banks or Lizzo?
No, Lizzo. Yeah. The reason I give Lizzo a pass for sort of being somewhat of a stereotype, she can, and I'm going to say this, and I don't care who tweets me, it's at Matt Brown Comic. No, it's not. I don't use that account anymore. Lizzo is a better singer than Beyonce.
Well, yeah. I mean, Beyonce's never been known as a great singer. Like, Beyonce,
okay, no. So we're both going to die tonight. Like, we're both going to disappear like Jimmy Hoffa. A teamster is going to kill us.
She's talented and she's wonderful, but it's like, you know, that's the reason she played, you know, Marion Dreamgirls. She was the role that was like, she's and the pretty girl. She's the dynamo.
She's not the vocal dynamo. No. That goes to Jennifer Hudson.
Yeah. But the other reason I'm willing to give Lizzo a pass is because this is her first. She is first a classically trained musician. She went to one of the top five schools in the country for music. Houston is like a completely undersung music city, but that is a music city. She went to college in Houston for fucking flute. So she's like educated and intelligent and like definitely an academic. And this is her like first big album. let's talk like 6 years when she has a chance to do a couple more albums, develop the career a little bit more her way. You can't really judge people on their initiation too hard because generally the terms of entrance are not up to you.
Mm. So are you agreeing or disagreeing?
I agree with Azalea Banks, but I'm saying I give Lizzo a pass.
Hard. Yeah.
So hold on a second. Azalea Banks is not wanting to give Lizzo a pass.
Azalea Banks is saying Lizzo is an amazing talent, and she appreciates the Bozzy talk, but she's acting like a clown.
Analytically, I agree with Azalea, but like emotionally, I'm down with Lizzo. Mm-hmm. But the other reason, because a lot of times the reasons that arguments like this can be taken down is because people say, oh, you're preaching respectability politics. You're saying if we act a certain way, we'll be accepted by white people. That is not what I believe she's saying. When I would say something like that, when she says something like that, what I think she's saying is if you can be seen as a symbol of black empowerment and a white guy can stare at you on TV and say, look at that fat black cunt. And if it's 50-50, there's a problem. You need to be very, very clearly one thing and you need to present yourself in a way so that way that one thing is noticeable. Because if you are equal parts laughing stock and like social commentator, have you reserved your space in that like social commentary philosophical spot? I think not. That's why like comedians as social commentator, they get that credit after they stop being funny 30 years into their career.
Lizzo's also being accused of stealing I just took a DNA test. It turns out I'm 100% that bitch.
Sure.
It sounds like something somebody else
being a songwriter is exactly like being a comedian. They're only like,
there's only so many ways
to talk about something. And then also, I can have the same premise as seven other people, but if they're going to take it in seven different directions, so it doesn't matter.
But does Lizzo get the trademark the phrase or not?
No, if other people also,
have used it and have posted it on social media already.
And that's okay if you like incorporate a tweet or a saying into your song. That's you know cute. What I mean? It's fine.
That's but adorable. Do you get to trademark it? Here's another example. No. Okay, so Daniel Quasar, we had him on the podcast. Mm-hmm. He helped animate the Cooking with Drag Queens intro.
Beautiful. Season 3 coming soon.
Season 3 coming soon, youtube.com/feastoffun. But so Daniel Quasar is now world famous for designing the Progress Pride flag.
Yeah.
Which is a triangle with the stripes of LGBT and a black and a brown stripe, drawing attention to LGBT people of color. Thrusting into the more traditional six color rainbow.
So all the crayons flag are on the fucking page and he wants a fucking $1 million for it or whatever.
He doesn't. He's actually donating a lot of the money to he's not making a lot of money in the first place about it, but he's donating a lot of the money to really good charities. You can read more about that on his blog.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some I wouldn't call them TERFs because they are invested in inclusivity. But there's a couple of Puerto Ricans who are mad at Daniel because they say his Progress Pride flag is appropriating the Puerto Rican Pride flag. Now,
okay.
I just want to say for the record, in 1998,
the year of my birth,
the year you were born, I took the rainbow flag and I had seen the American flag and I said, we should have one for Puerto Rico. And I designed it so the triangle of Puerto Rico would be a pink triangle with a white star in the middle and a rainbow flag. And my sister liked that and she started sharing that with her friends. I don't know if that eventually grew to be the Puerto Rican pride flag, but so somebody in 2000 copyrighted that exact design that I came up with. And yes, I also have had my lipstick lesbian pride flag stolen as well. And now these people are like going around saying that Daniel's stealing. I'm like, I'm the designer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm okay with it. I'm cool with it. It's not appropriating. I'm Puerto Rican and queer. I'm the person who made that thing. Go
you
didn't
make
it
for you. You made it for other people.
I made it to put on my AOL profile, you know?
Well, now that you bring this up, it's starting to make me think of more like my knowledge of comedy legal history. And like in the 80s, Joan Rivers copyrighted the phrases Can We Talk and Oh, Grow Up. She trademarked both of them. She was not the first person to say either of those things.
Because she has a lawyer to pursue any way. It.
Yeah.
I do not have those means and resources.
Well, you're the one who chose to be poor. And an immigrant.
Immigrating from inside the United States.
Yeah, how dare you? Well, it's your territory.
And so people ask me, it's like, you know, am I going to sue for the lipstick lesbian flag or the Puerto Rican pride flag? And I'm kind of like, I can prove that I did those things. I have evidence because those were posted on the internet. But at the same time, I'm kind of like, they were not designed to have property or value to me. Mm-hmm. They were just designed to start a conversation about identity and to include different kind of people into the idea of progress and pride, you know?
I like the way you look at it, because when you are talking about, when you're talking about social movements, when you're talking about civil rights, it's not something you do for you.
Yeah.
It's not something
now,
you do for
not
you.
Not shaving gives me more time for misbehaving, which is available, and it's our best-selling design mm-hmm. at feastoffun.com. Second one is the Hunty University thing.
Slash store.
At feastoffun.com/store, you can get it. We actually hand-make those shirts, and we'll sign them if you put that in the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, have seen people try to steal it, but thankfully, they've done a really, really shitty job of stealing the design. Mm-hmm. But other people have taken those pride flags that were designed way, way in the past and copy them pixel by pixel. Mm-hmm. Like, you overlay it. They didn't even nudge
color. Didn't try.
Nothing. You put those two images on top of each other and use the overlay filter and the difference layer adjustment in Photoshop, you get a black image, which proves beyond legal doubt that those exactly the same images.
I'm sorry. I feel like I'm having like a real life sort of like I'm having an Oprah aha moment with you right now.
Yeah.
I really am. Like, how so? It's Super Soul Sunday, because the way you talk about your conception of these like artistic visions of like whatever movement you feel like you're a part of, whatever community you feel like you want to represent, it sort of reminds me in the way that I talk to other comedians and the way that I visualize for myself, sort of like some of my own achievements. It's like, for example, like I am probably, I don't have a lawyer, so I can't go do the research and find out. But like, I am probably the first gay black comedian who produced a show that was produced at like a chain of clubs as a teenager.
Okay.
I produced a show at the Laugh Factory, which is like a chain of clubs throughout the country.
Which you want to see other queer people of color making art and work.
I did that as a 19-year-old. I did that as a part of, you know, a show that was, you know, in place with two other women. I did all that stuff already. But what I'm saying is I don't take that credit because first, I don't know I'm the first. But second, I don't take that credit to be anything I did. I take that because I know that over the next 40 years, there's going to be a time when I am not the only gay black guy who does stand up in a town, and I want them to have like a history. Sure. I want them to have like something to look back on, because I started this as someone who did not have any role models, anyone to say this is someone else who is like me who did this job. And so when I do stuff like that, like when I try to, you know, work really hard and achieve these things, it's not like I want to be in the Guinness Book of World Records. It's because, for the same reasons you do, this is the community I represent. This is who I am. This is for future. This is for what's important. Like, if I get a little recognition now, cute. But it's for past that. It's for beyond that.
Well, I mean, you know, in terms of like innovations that we've done, or is podcasting is the most widely adopted innovation we've done. When we first started podcasting, there were 45 shows, you know, and all of them were people reading their blogs. Those are the only program that... This format of the program is what most podcasts are like today, with the exception, I would say that. Well, the crime serials are an innovation.
Basically, you're gay Joe Rogan and you want $1 billion too. You want to sell out a stadium right now.
No, I mean, it would be nice, you know, and certainly we rely deeply on the support of the listeners to exist.
Listeners.
But to me, it's like it's part of it is this idea that we as LGBTQ people, we are very excited about innovation and the new shiny trinket that we can attach ourselves to.
Because we are the edge of society, so we should be on the edge of creation, right?
Yeah, we're generations ahead of yesterday. But at the same time, that mindset also robs us of sort of appreciating and understanding our own history. And like a lot of people don't even know the name of the person who designed the Rainbow Pride flag.
Not at all.
And that he wanted that Pride flag to be infinitely redesigned by generations of people to come.
I think that ignorance, though, is funny. And I do jokes about that. Like, I did a joke on Twitter on Labor Day about, like, how Diana Ross didn't sew the American flag so you could take this day off for no reason. And then I put a picture of a white person who had a tattoo of Nina Simone on their arm. like with the tweet. Like, people who are so fucking stupid as fuck would just be like, yeah, you know what? That is my Black queer history. You're right. No, you got to read a book. You got to try. You got to sort of really appreciate who you are and what you come from, because every other ethnic culture has a religion to look back on, has certain history to look back on, has fucking cave paintings to go look on.
Yeah, everybody has one.
So we should appreciate ourselves in the same way. No,
there's a historian I follow on Twitter, and she's like so sick of people being like, they just ignore that history. And was like, no, just because you didn't pick up a history book out of high school doesn't mean that people haven't written extensively on this topic.
I am sorry.
Go to a library.
Yeah, I'm sorry you majored in economics and never took any interest in yourself till you were 32.
Yeah.
Like, I'm really sorry you just didn't want to figure out where you came from in an intellectual capacity until right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does bother me when I'm like tuning in to NPR because there's nothing else to listen to on the radio going to work, and they're like,
"You mean you're not in love with Diana Rehm?"
Well, and they make the expression
wrong Rehm.
They make the
okay, sorry, that just took me.
So when I'm listening to NPR and they make the expression, nobody's talking about blank, and it was literally the topic of the last 10 podcasts we had on.
Yes, I was talking about it.
You know, and I'm just like,
intelligent, educated people are clearly talking about
it. And I'm like, we're talking about this. You're just not listening and you don't care to listen to us, and you're not interested. You're wanting to crush us. You're not interested in our thriving.
A quick Google search.
Oh, yeah. You could Google search these topics and they'd be here.
But, you know, it's very similar. Being on the internet as someone who owns their own business and tries to promote their own product, I find, is actually very, very similar. You might relate to this because you went to college in Texas in the 90s. It's like being a student of color writing a scholarship. It's like you have to make your suffering sexy to get someone to give you a dollar.
It does, you know, the idea of funding the arts is tied to sort of social work.
Yeah.
And there was a sort of a criticism, especially of performance artists in the 90s, that they were like, which marginalized children and after school programs will you be working with?
We are the world.
And there was a lot of that. You know, there was a lot of like video editing programs teaching you know, Latino kids. The one was Video Machete. It was teaching kids basically out of a video blog in our own neighborhood for a good decade.
I would love to watch Little Mexican Boys vlog about like skateboarding and shit.
That was basically it.
I would be, and
it was on cable access.
That would be so fucking cool. That would be an entire sociology class at my college.
It wasn't bad. Like some of the work that was made, you know, and certainly like super my friend, Sheila Murphy did a series called Selling Shakti. And she worked with a lot of trans, which was very ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. This is 1993.
Okay, but can we
1993 get in- working with gender non-binary and trans high school students of color.
Can we get into that whole trans as revolutionary whole thing here for a second?
Because what's to that? Find people that were openly queer and of color and marginalized in the early 90s who were willing to do after school programs for basically nothing was extraordinary.
Thank you for pointing that out, because nowadays trans, queer, non-binary, drag queens all have to be marketable to fucking 9-year-olds, and people don't understand that there was a world in which we, every single man at this table, would be considered to be a fucking child molester, and you keep them away from your kids. It's a completely different energy now. It's a completely different energy now. And something that I think is so funny is that I appreciate the current movement that we have right now that says, like, Janet Mock, Laverne Cox, like, I'm the first. We're going in. We're telling our own stories. I love every second of it. But I grew up in fucking Springfield, Illinois, graduated high school, you know, in 2016. I can name 5 guys off the top of my head who wore prom dresses to prom. There were a lot of Black guys who weren't trans, but were like on that non-binary femme track, who didn't have the vocabulary for it, who just existed as that way. And it was not an issue. It was not a conversation. That was Jasper. That was Dre. That's who they were.
They were the Pepper LaBeiges of their day.
Yes. And so that's why I'm very comfortable wearing like a fucking sweater and a jeans on stage and then a ton of eye makeup and shit, because I come from an environment where none of that shit's a conversation and none of that shit's deep. It's just understood. So then to come to all this stuff, it's so wild and so interesting. Like, it's just like, what do you mean?
I sent you another tweet from somebody else put out here that said, you said you objected to it. The tweet was,
what I say?
Tyler, the Creator, fucking all these little white boys and distracting them from becoming mass shooters is Black excellence.
Because gay guys don't shoot schools. Anyone who wants to get fucked in the ass does not want to pick up a gun. You're already laying down.
You're already holding on the meat gun, honey. And that shoots protein.
Exactly, exactly. You know what I'm saying? And
don't put
I
it
also,
on your face.
I don't
it.
Trust black people who get $5 and then won't fuck anyone who looks like them. I'm not down for it. I'm not down for it at all.
It's really
is
important
that who is
to celebrate
probably if he's
your
fucking
heritage,
the white boys.
Especially if you're a marginalized person.
Yeah.
Celebrate your heritage in the bedroom.
You got to celebrate your, because that's, it's not just the bedroom. It's the family.
But I'll
create,
tell you this.
It's the life you nourish.
When I'm hot for somebody who's Puerto Rican or Mexican or Latino, and they find out that I speak Spanish and I'm from Puerto Rico, sometimes they reject me because of that.
Yeah.
Because they can't talk about me or they can't manipulate me because I'm onto their tricks.
Well, they want you to be white American, right?
Yeah.
They want you to
so
be
they know they,
attracted to their foreignness.
Yeah. And part
that's
of me is like,
have.
Look, I share the same culture. I went to the same high school that your older brother went to, you know, like I know everything about that I celebrate and it's fun to be part of your culture. And they're just like, no, thanks.
Oh, totally. Because there are a lot of people who come from communities of color, who come from communities of oppression, who view people who are similar to them as like a reproduction of that oppression. So why would a Puerto Rican guy who had to deal with all that stuff come to the United States, who wants to make a better life for himself, than just like, you know, bring his social life and his sexual life, everything just deeper into the hole of brown oppression?
And that, like, was true for me for the first like 10 years, you know, and it was only until like I started like opening up my pants
and
my mouth and asshole. And realize that, like, I was really robbing myself of the richness and, you know, sexiness of who I am.
Dick. Oh, sorry. I just started talking about my own life.
And part of it is, like, to be queer in this day and age is, especially to be young and queer, is to some degree hate who you are. And I think, like, an artist.
You really think that still?
I think, you know, in terms of, like, someone like Lizzo. What we're talking about sometimes is overcompensation. And I think Azalea Banks is addressing that. She's just not maybe able to vocalize it.
She went on.
That this is all data driven. It's white executives controlling it, kind of stuff.
But it's
they're afraid
it's
of the Black Lives Matter
tapping onto
movement.
This idea that you have to sell, you know, like I told you this, honey, I am more tastier and more desirable than a Popeye's fried chicken sandwich.
harder to find.
And part of it is like, it's this idea that you have to, I'm just joking about that. Like, I know.
Yeah.
I want everybody who listens to the show to understand your value, and wherever it is, charge twice as much because you're probably undervaluing yourself.
You're worth it, baby.
That's right.
Just like Lifetime used to say in the 90s, you're a woman and you're worth it. Oh, God. I've seen all those movies where you're bulimic and hiding it from your husband and shit. I love Lifetime.
The Hallmark Channel is making, I think, 40 Christmas movies this year.
You know what's
thank 50? God.
Okay, do you know what's really funny? When I was a little kid, when I was in high school, and I was like a 14-year-old gay boy in Springfield, Illinois, my highest ambition for my life is that one day I could be a makeup artist on Hallmark movies.
I aww. Love those. Do you love them as much as I do?
Oh, so it's I'm the same movie with 40 different
exactly
people in it. It's like
it.
Repertory theater.
It's right. It's like Shakespeare, but you know, it's the same play.
Summer's Stock, you mean?
There's
Summer
no black
stock.
Guy, so there's no Othello. But other than that, it's
yeah. And it's like if you go to like a community forums about TV shows, it's usually people who are really excited about a TV program. Like if you go to the Dark Crystal forum on Reddit, everyone's like, oh, I love Dark Crystal. Somebody shared with me like an edit that they made of the original film with lost footage, which shows Gelflin's shirtless. And I go to the Good Witch forum. And it's everybody's hating on the Good Witch.
But have you noticed that about like the internet and TV? There's no space to be like, hey, I like the episode, but I didn't understand this component. It's always like I was in love with it, or like everyone on there should die.
Yeah.
Especially Drag Race culture is very like that. There's no space to be like, I don't know how I feel about this queen yet. It's week two. I don't know if I like her or not yet.
And
there's
having
no space
watched the Queen documentary, I'm now very conscious that the filmmakers the TV producers that make RuPaul's Drag Race are trying to tap into that sense of outrage in their viewers to get them to watch.
Miss Vanjie, and also the sense of being lost.
I mean, that's just why Aquaria won in some degree, mm-hmm. even though she's a great drag queen and very visually stunning. Part of it was she was cast and other people were cast on that show to sort of recreate that injustice and that tension to get us to talk about
it. If there's a framework that you can already place people in, it's a lot easier to understand everyone, place everybody, and mm-hmm. make your decisions. It makes for good TV, but it makes for predictable TV, and it makes me think that season 13, 14 may be closing towards something up if they're already at that point.
Oh, you think?
Because there's a lot of really diverse, really interesting talent out there. Like, you're telling me that there's not a fucking drag queen in fucking Idaho right now who's not full on, like, should be, like, out there? Like, not everything's located to cities anymore, and, like, there's just so much more going on. I want them to focus on weird queens. I want them to focus on queens like Kim and Trixie and, like, these queens that are really specific images, that are specific, like, art messages even. They can get really weird and really specific and put a really shining, intelligent light on performance art. I think they did that a
little bit with Evie Oddly, for sure.
To a point, yeah. To a point, definitely. Mm-hmm. You could argue that point even with, like, Trixie and, like, Katya and, like, Bob even.
Oh, without
like,
a doubt.
Bob was, like, a stand-up comedian who would lip-sync other people's stand-up and then do music and then do their own. That's very original and odd, honestly, but cool.
Mm. I mean, what's her name? When we saw Monique perform at Milwaukee Pride Fest, she didn't even actually perform her comedy routine. She just had Ivy White come out and lip sync 15, 20 minutes of her act.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of her entire act. And people
the actual
loved
real
it.
Monique, the comedian Monique.
Monique. And then after she was done, Monique came out and just got up there and just bullshitted with the audience for a while. It was fantastic.
Oh, I love her. Mm-hmm. She's great to see in a club, too, because her energy is so, because she was a Schaumburg a couple years ago. And my friend Corey Bell actually was her opener in Las Vegas for her whole residency that mm-hmm. she had for 6 months. And she's going to work on the road with her more. But Monique is all about, she's not a good special comedian because she does have good, smart material that's like been worked on. But she's there as an energy and she's there about that interaction mm-hmm. with the audience. And that the she is so special because you know that that one show you got is not going to be mm-hmm. like any other one that's going to be on that tour. But comedians that do great, brilliant specials that everyone loves are more predictable.
Yeah.
So she's a different style than what's super marketable right now.
And she's unapologetic. And she's very wise.
She doesn't give a fuck. She doesn't need to. Have you seen her husband? She's getting fucked good, get fucked hard, getting fucked regular. She doesn't need to.
Well, she also has an open relationship. Do you know where she keeps the Oscar that she won?
Where does she keep it? In her bathroom?
No, in the pantry.
That's funny. Like, I need rice and yes.
Well, because she wanted to do a salute to all the African-American women who portrayed maids throughout the history of Hollywood.
That's amazing.
And so she's just like, that's where I want to keep it. We did an interview with her and she's at the end of it. She's like, you know, I like you guys because I gave you an hour, but I got to go.
She don't give a fuck.
No, but I loved it. Could you imagine? I mean, she had just won the Oscar like the year before. Mm-hmm. She gave us a little piss at nobody podcast like Feast of Fun. A whole hour.
Oh, I saw her
realize who you are and charge twice as much.
Yes,
that's right. Saw her and how much is it?
How much is it?
It's $14 a month. You can get yourself access to Monique, to mm-hmm. the amazing podcast we did with Monique.
Two tricks you mentioned. Two
or
Kim,
on Patreon.
And Mateo Lane, who everyone thinks I am.
You're the
dear Mariah.
You're the Mateo Lane with new material.
That's all I got. That's all I fucking got. I smoke cigarettes, honey. It's over.
Oh, don't
it's over.
With now 80% new material. You can listen to all those amazing podcasts on feastoffund.com. And for our Patreon subscribers who don't have as many resources, you can listen. We're going to repost our podcast with Monique on Patreon for just $1 a month.
God, Monique is just full on genius level. And I cannot wait for her to get her due respect like Martin Lawrence and like Bernie Mac and the rest of the guys from the 90s that she's defined, you know, she came up with. She's on their level. She's on their level.
I agree with that. Yeah. And Monique is somebody who I enjoy so much. And I'm really disappointed that, you mm-hmm. know, Netflix did not
$500,000 together. $500,000 because that's not.
And they gave what's his name? Dave Chappelle, who just put out that piece of shit comedy special.
OK, I kind of like
everybody's like, what? What was up with that?
The other main reason I respect Monique so much is because we vibe on the same level of I just want you to talk about me and look at me and interact with me the same way you do all those straight black guys. If you could just treat me the way you would like anyone else who you thought had a dick that worked, that'd be really cool. So, like, I very much vibe with that. I kind of like the Dave Chappelle special, especially the joke about Kevin Hart, because it's like, why would you take the joke about a dollhouse seriously? You have to buy the kid a dollhouse and then beat their ass with it. You're clearly supporting the faggotry and then fucking them up. Like, like, that's funny as hell.
I didn't hear that part.
That's funny as hell. Yeah. Like, you're going to beat up with a dollhouse. You had to buy it for stupid. Like, that's funny as hell, because that's how a comedian's mind works.
Right.
We go four layers deep. Mm-hmm. We see past what would already be there, and we expect you to kind of go there with us sometimes.
I haven't heard it. I haven't heard the comedy special yet, and I understand there's some trans stuff, and people aren't happy with
it. He will never let that go for the rest of his career. Probably. Because it's been associated with him, and he's always going to keep egging you on, telling you to go fuck yourself.
And I think for a lot of people, you know, with trans people I see, and I've said this before on the podcast many times, it's not that it's you tell a joke about a trans person. It's often it's the same joke. And it's the same.
It's not original. It's not interesting.
And over and over. And so you just get tired of hearing it. You know, it's like let's say there's something about you that people make fun of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you hear it once. Ha ha ha. You hear it twice. You hear it three times. And then it's like every day you hear the same.
I have
joke.
A big fucking forehead. I get it.
Yeah.
Like it's really that. It's very fucking that.
Mm-hmm.
With Dave, though, what I find to be most interesting is that he like walked away from mm-hmm. a TV show because he was like, people are laughing from the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't trust like
and the way that they're
interpreting.
Right?
Yeah. And I don't trust the way they're interpreting this struggle.
Breakdown, honey.
I don't know about all that. I just think you wanted to go breathe
if
somewhere.
You have a successful show, this is what I always tell people. And I told this to Rachel Hall. I'm telling this to you. Who's in charge?
A lot of people.
Who's in charge?
It's a television
show.
It's a television show. Everything has to go by 40
who
people.
Who walked away from the show?
Dave Chappelle.
So who was in charge?
Because he had to deal with 30 other executives.
You know, he could have said, I'm going to do a different show. I could try something. You know what he said? He said, I'm done. And that's not showing that he's in control. He's saying he has to jump out the window.
If you are the lead person, but you have a board of directors that is made up of 30 people with a diverse group of interests, sometimes it's a lot easier to walk away than it is to argue with executive producers and writers and network executives who all want different shit out of you and none of it aligns with what you're supposed
Oprah
to do.
Oprah wakes up in the morning and says, oh, I have so many people I have to deal with.
Dave Chappelle doesn't own his own network.
Well, you know, not any. He could have.
Oprah could barely get own off the ground.
He just walked away from it. And listen, I want to support people to mm-hmm. do the choices that they want to make.
Mm-hmm.
And if walking away from a very successful career is what you need to do to wake up the next day and be a happy person, do that.
I want to make the point because a lot of people say,
don't mistake that with not being in charge, because he was in charge.
He did not walk away from a successful career. He walked away from a successful show.
TV show,
one of the gifts of being a stand-up comedian is that no one can ever take a dollar out of your pocket because you can always work. So long as there's fucking five people in front of you and a microphone and a booker with two brain cells together.
Girl, you're not going to live on that.
Always work.
You're not going to live on tip jar money.
You can always work.
Or a pole.
But you can always do your job and always be in front of people and always have a skill set to offer and always be working on a writing skill. It's all transferable. Mm-hmm. It's all connected and it never goes anywhere.
I want to do a
if you're funny, you're funny.
Yes.
I want to do a shout out to Ireland, who hosted a big gay disco for the arrival of Vice President Mike Pence.
Top of the morning to ye.
And to the country of Iceland, who the mayor of Reykjavik put up all the rainbow gay flags, and all the business owners all put out their gay flags to welcome Mike Pence.
Thank you, Bjork. Thank you. All those guys in the 90s who, like, you were there playing in the background when they became mm-hmm. positive. Like, thank you for letting them all call you and talk them into talking the governor of this. Yeah. Because that's precisely what happened.
I think
it was a chain of command.
Very important to support the LGBTQ community.
Did you ever see the interview where she's like, I kind of think that the television gives you cancer. Like, it was wild. She's on a different like playing
that
field.
That was a weird video that she made for like cable access in Ireland back in the day. And that was being passed around in New York City all the time. You know, when people, before the internet, people would pass VHS tapes. You could watch Bjork freaking out about the inside of a television set on YouTube. It inspired this woman, this comedian who lived in, I think it was Australia. She came on our show.
She did.
Yeah. And she basically
did. No. She did.
She did. I don't think she was a lesbian, wasn't she, Mark?
No, I don't think she was.
Do you remember her?
I do remember her. I remember she was Australian.
She did Australian. And she did a series of her impersonating Bjork.
Oh, that's funny.
And it was brilliant, you know, and then she ended it because she has a life.
Yeah. And then also people are sort of starting to forget about Bjork, unfortunately. Like, her discography has not kept up with the times. Mm. And also everyone thinks she's Asian. So that's like also complicated.
I know Iceland gave her a house somewhere, like basically the end of the earth.
They gave her an igloo. She's Mrs. Claus. That's actually what's happening. Bjork has to fuck Santa, and that's why you get presents.
Matt Brown, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
And it's always a pleasure to see me at the Comedy Bar tomorrow night on September 5th at 8 p.m. and at the Laugh Factory on September 5th.
You mean tonight?
No, tomorrow, baby.
Friday?
Oh, yeah, Friday. Yeah.
Thursday or Friday night?
Okay. No, Thursday, my darlings. Okay. Thursday.
So tonight?
Yeah, because it's not Beyonce's birthday.
Anymore.
It's a government holiday. I respect some things. And then you can also see me at the Laugh Factory on September 13th on highly recommended at the Laugh Factory.
Is that Friday? September 13th?
Thursday or Friday. And then also I'm going to be doing Sashay at the Laugh Factory, which is on September 20th, which is their gay pride show. And
Queen, work it.
It's like their second or Friday third one, and they picked a bitch.
Friday the 13th, honey. And yes. You're going to get murdered. You're going to kill the audience.
Well, I mean, it's a show about weed and I'm high right now. So we should be okay.
I noticed.
Well, all right.
A little bit.
Smoking if you got it.
Grace. Well, we want to thank the people who tuned in to listen to today's Feast of Fun podcast. Mm-hmm. Remember, when you hear those no's, it's like Crystal LaBeija. It may set something in motion that will change the world forever.
And just remember, you have every right to show your color. Every right.
Every right.
You were born with it.
Just because somebody says you can't doesn't mean you can't.
And even if you weren't born with it, maybe it's Maybelline and you bought it, so it's fine.
Honey, CoverGirl covers everybody.
You know, yes. Maybelline started right around the corner from here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They make really good concealers.
Oh, yeah. Bye.
Bye.